Well, let's move on to the experience at Lewiston Auburn. Mac Richardson is on the line. Mac, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Ned. I have also with me Travis Teasley and Isaiah Larry, some of our team here. We have two 230 kW Liebherr engines. They were highly recommended by the consultant that we had at the time, and that's really why we ended up with the Liebherr units, which is may be able to guess is a German engine.
We
looked at micro turbines. We felt that at the time, a few things. One, the number of manufacturers making micro turbines was declining, and we were concerned about gas quality and the parasitic load that micro turbines had. And really, in general, felt that reciprocating engines was just a more mature and robust, if you will, technology. So I guess that's that. We do use all our electricity on site. We are using the reclaimed heat to heat the anaerobic digesters. Next slide, I guess. We start off with foam separator, condensate sediment traps, and H2S removal. We looked at both the iron sponge and sulfa treat. We felt the iron sponge made more sense. The vessel's larger. If we wanted to put sulfa treat media in, we could. So we thought it was a little bit more forgiving or versatile. We have a gas conditioning skid that removes the last of the moisture. We have now added siloxane removal to activated carbon columns.
And this is this slide is from an older presentation, so that change has been made.
Right,
as you say,
we do siloxane. Now have the siloxane removal.
Yeah.
Yes, and I will say right out of the gate, we have had a failure of both engines. You can see here is, I think, the second failure, where you can see what happened to the piston and the cylinder there. We had Liebherr come in and do an evaluation of the engine. The first time we had a failure, we threw a piston right through the block, and so that couldn't be repaired. We actually got a new engine. The second failure, we were able to shut it down a little bit quicker, and we're able to just have the engine rebuilt up at the Liebherr facility in Ontario, Canada.
What was the reasoning figured out for the two different failures?
Well, the supplier blamed it completely on siloxane. Personally, and I don't know, neither Travis or Isaiah can chime in if they want, but I don't believe that personally. I think that really it came to either the engine not switching. On the first case, we had actually switched over to natural gas, and the engine was programmed to compensate for that automatically, and maybe that compensation didn't happen. The natural gas burns hotter than the biogas, so maybe that's what caused it. I don't know. The second failure, I believe, was caused by what's called detonation. In other words, it's kind of like knocking in your car. If you have the engine fire before it's at the appropriate place in the travel of the piston. You want to comment on any of that, Travis?
I think they were both detonation, and we've had multiple firms into do forensics, and they say there's, you know, hundreds of reasons why detonation happens. It could be air to fuel, hot cylinders, you know, you could have a head gasket leak. There's also, you know, there's all sorts of reasons for it, and I don't think anyone, you know, was there to say what caused either of them, but... detonation was definitely behind both cylinders going.
So we have now installed detonation sensors on both engines so that if the sequence of firing gets slightly out of phase, if you will, maybe that's a bad way to put it, but it will detect that and will shut down the engines. And I would highly recommend that to anyone that's considering this. You know, a few general comments. We've found the need to get local people that can help us service both the engines plus the generators that are attached to the engines themselves. Liebherr is a firm, Tech 3 was the supplier. They're out of Florida and have a lot of their tech support back in Germany. You know, sometimes it's hard to get people, as Jim was mentioning, on a as-needed basis. So we found that the two local firms around here that we think can help us the most are either Kraft or Martin Machinery. But I think that's important. We talked about gas quality, detonation sensors. One thing that I would mention is that when we started, we were going to put these units in shipping containers. Got discovered a little bit later than optimum that, the size engines that we had wouldn't fit in the shipping containers and give us any room at all. So we ended up building a building, which we have found that we really like because it does give us the access for maintenance. That's just something that we found and that we like. Anything on that? Just wanted to mention briefly the air permit. That's been a little bit, that was a little painful for us because the supplier came in saying, ours are low-emission engines and they meet all the standards and everything. And we went round and round and round with our DEP Air Bureau and EPA and kept on saying, well, tell us what the standard is and we'll meet it. You know, what do we have to do? We're not air experts. And we got lots of really ambiguous answers for a long time. We ended up having to spend $7,500 per engine to have them tested after the fact. So that wasn't real great. We've had a number of VFD failures in our cabinet. They're mounted right on the engine, so we've had like six of them, I believe. The supplier of our engines is using motor starters instead due to that vibration and so forth. We've also had sensors some other components that have failed due to vibration. So that's something to look for. We do find that it's best to ramp up and ramp down the engine slowly rather than put them through start and stop cycles. Certainly, we're trying to run the engines more uniformly. One of the big reasons is that overwhelmingly our power bill is driven by demand charges. So running them more smoothly helps us get off that 15-minute determining demand cycle that Jim mentioned. We've also had some issues with the heat piping insulation and also wiring insulation. You know, inside the sound enclosures, these things do get quite hot, and so you have to be a little careful of where those various components are. And lastly, I guess we've really worked hard to train our staff to do as much as we can in-house to take care of these things, and we are learning all the time. So I know that's quick, but I know we didn't have much time. Anything else, Travis, that you would add, or Isaiah? I think we're maybe ready for questions.
Questions.
What were the run hours on each of the failures?
Oh, the first one was, boy, I have it somewhere, but it was not much. The first failure, what?
Around 8,000.
Travis was saying around 8,000, and the second one was like three times that, 24,000 or something, if I recall correctly.
I think it was like 12 or 13.
But anyway, yeah, the first failure happened pretty quickly. So live and learn, I guess. But we'll knock on wood. Lately, we haven't had as many difficulties with these engines.
How have the run times been in the last year or so since that stuff was taken care of? Failures.
The engines themselves, other than, like I say, some of these, you know, you get a sensor that goes bad because of vibration, or maybe the wire that, you know, connects the sensor, the insulation melted through or something. We seem to get a little bit of that. But the other issue that knocks them down quite a bit is just the whole gas conditioning skid, the chiller, and knocking out all the moisture from the gas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mac, do you run 24/7?
We pretty much do, yep.
So you have an operator on at night and weekends?
We do not. We have a call-out procedure. We're only staffed here 10 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It's all done via SCADA, Richard. It's we run lead lag controls based on gas volume in our storage tank. And our protocol has been not to call anybody in if we have engine failures after hours.
Yeah, I guess that's an important point. If anything happens with this, the system shuts down, and then it gets addressed, you know, the next morning.
Yep. What percentage of your electric use are you running with these engines?
Well, it really depends a lot. We start out with a sort of interim means of feeding feedstocks into the digesters. The point from where we take the feedstocks is sort of a torturous route in a way, because we have to pump from the receiving tank over to our thickened waste-activated sludge tanks, and we try to mix that, and then it gets sent out, boy, I don't know, what is it, 400 yards or so? Maybe not quite that far, but...
350 feet.
It's only 350 feet. It just seems like a lot longer, I guess. But we've had a lot of problems with fouling of our flow meters and just taking of the lines and the valves and all. And so we've been pretty aggressive with pigging those. When we're taking feedstocks, I know it's a long way around the horn to get to the answer. When we were taking feedstocks pretty aggressively, I think we got up pretty close to about 60% of our energy use. That sound about right?
Yeah, on average, 60%. I mean, there's good portions of the day where we're actually exporting power.
Yeah,
I mean, once you consider shutdowns and maintenance, and, you know, the periods where we're using a lot of aeration blowers or insulin pumping, it's probably 60-65%.
So the other half of that is that now we're playing around a little bit to see how much the feedstocks really impact those flow meter issues and the clogging of our pipes and valves and so forth. So once we've done that, we're probably down to about 40% of our power need from the cogens.
Yeah, Mac, at GLSD with our pilot program, as I said, we're taking about 19,000 gallons per day of feedstock, and we're having similar issues with the piping. We have a hot water flush system that we have to utilize a lot more often, and we had some major problems with trying to use sludge flow meters, and we've switched over pretty successfully to a food grade flow meter.
Huh. We'll have to talk about that down at the NUIA annual conference, Richard.
Yes, we can do that.
But, I would say that is, if you're looking at cogeneration at wastewater treatment plants, feedstocks are great as far as the energy, but the handling issues are something to really pay attention to.
Agreed.
Okay, well, we've come pretty much to the end of the hour, and it's probably good to finish up at this point, unless anybody has one last question or comment. So thank you all.
Did we did well, or we baffled everyone with a bunch of BS?
Yeah, I think you did well. I learned a good deal, and I think there were some good questions and discussion. I appreciate it, Mac. Thank you for your time, and Travis and Isaiah as well. Sherry and Richard at Greater Lawrence, thank you for your time. And Jim Jutris over there at Essex Junction, thanks for putting in the effort to put together a good program today. In the end, this was recorded, and it's a separate recording from the slide, so we will make available, unless anyone has objections, we'll make available the recording and the slides on the Northeast Digestion Roundtable website. So you can move the slides forward yourselves and listen to the recording. So thank you all very much for joining in today. The next Digestion Roundtable is on April 6th, another Friday at 12 noon, and we'll be talking about how food scraps and other organics work in municipal digesters. This will feature Matt Higgins from Bucknell University, who's done some of the leading research on organic waste utilization at municipal wastewater digesters. So thank you all again very much. Happy New Year, and we'll be in touch. Take care.
Stay warm, all.
Stay warm.
Bye.